The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, providing you with daily news from around the world since 1985. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, September 11th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on today's show, we'll talk soccer. The world's most popular sport will be the subject of a new honors seminar on the University of Arkansas campus, and we'll talk with Todd Cleveland about his approach to the class. First, Arkansas is one of five states without a state hate crime law. The others are Georgia, Indiana, South Carolina, and Wyoming. During the 2017 legislative session, two Arkansas Democrats sponsored a bill that would have created enhanced sentences for hate crimes, but that bill never made it out of committee. Hate crimes in general across the country are also difficult to track. For both of those reasons, the Arkansas Times joined a ProPublica-run project called Documenting Hate. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek has this report.
Federal law states the FBI has to ask state and local law enforcement agencies for reports of hate crimes. The most recent stats from the FBI for 2015 indicate there were just shy of 6,000 hate crime reports across the country that year. But there's a problem. Here's Arkansas Times editor Lindsay Miller.
In Arkansas in 2015, I think there were 279 participating agencies. Only four submitted records, producing a total of five incident reports. So I think just from a basic news standpoint, trying to get at that disparity is a really interesting challenge. And ProPublica has been on the front lines of these kind of crowdsourced partnerships.
State and local law enforcement agencies don't have to turn over their hate crime reports, which leads to the disparity Miller is referring to. The Bureau of Justice Statistics estimates an average of 250,000 hate crimes took place each year from 2004 to 2015, compared to the 6,000 incidents recorded by the FBI.
So there's obviously a huge gap between those two numbers.
That's Rachel Glickhouse from ProPublica. And this is where the organization's project called Documenting Hate comes in. ProPublica is a kind of nonprofit newsroom focused on investigative journalism in the public interest. And they've done this kind of crowdsourcing project before during the election.
A coalition-based project that looked at problem voting during early voting and on election day. And we worked with newsrooms around the country around a central sort of clearinghouse of tips, a database of tips that we gave access to newsrooms all over so that they could follow up and write stories.
Documenting Hate works in a similar way. Glickhouse says ProPublica created an online forum for victims and witnesses of hate crimes. The more than 100 newsrooms that are part of the project are also encouraged to share it on their website. The information submitted in the form is then collected in a database that's overseen by ProPublica.
We want to hear from victims and witnesses of some sort of hate incident. So if a person was targeted with intimidation, someone saying something using hate speech, if they saw or experienced vandalism, so someone spray painting something in public or on their property, obviously things like physical assault or robbery, and also things like threats and intimidation.
The journalists who are taking part in the Documenting Hate project have access to the database and help verify the incidents. The ProPublica form asks for a name and email. A phone number is optional. Then it asks the five W's: who, what, when, where, and why. Who did the incident happen to? What happened? When did it happen? Where did it happen? And why someone was targeted? ProPublica uses the FBI's definition of a hate crime for the why portion of the form. According to the FBI, a crime rises to a hate crime if it was committed because of the victim's race, color, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, or disability. The form also allows victims and witnesses to submit photos, videos, links to social media posts and news stories, as well as police reports, if one was filed. Glickhouse says all this information goes into the database, so journalists can use it to verify what happened.
A police report is great, but it's not a necessity for journalists to follow up. So we have journalists following up on all sorts of cases that have been reported to us.
Glickhaus says ProPublica has received a couple thousand submissions since the project launched in January. And journalists have verified about 500 of those incidents so far.
We have not found any made-up ones.
According to Glickhaus, hate crime hoaxes do happen, but the instances of actual hate crimes far outweigh the number of false reports.
This is an argument that is often used to sort of try to deny the fact that hate crimes happen, and boy, do they happen a lot.
So what's ProPublica going to do with all this information? Glickhaus says, as journalists, those participating in documenting hate don't have anything to do with seeking justice for the victims through the judicial system. But they are able to document and tell those stories, which Glickhaus hopes will add up to something greater.
What we're trying to do is get as much information as possible to show how big of an issue this is so that policymakers and legislators and whoever the case may be can actually take action to do something with this information that we gather.
Earlier this year, Arkansas Representative Greg Letting, a Democrat from Fayetteville, and Arkansas Senator Joyce Elliott, a Democrat from Little Rock, co-sponsored a bill that would have created stiffer penalties for anyone found guilty of a hate crime. It didn't make it out of committee. Here's Representative Letting.
The way it would have worked is it would have allowed for a bifurcated trial, which means that the first trial would have dealt only with the guilt or innocence of the accused. And had they been found guilty, then there'd be a second trial to determine whether or not hate was a motivating factor. And if so, then it would have allowed for an enhanced penalty of up to 20%, whatever the normal penalty would have been.
Letting says he actually wasn't aware Arkansas didn't have a hate crime law on the books until 2015. That's when a local reporter asked him about it after Dylan Roof walked into an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, and killed 9 people.
We are very much behind the times that we haven't come to realize that hate crimes are acts of terror that affect entire communities.
State Representative Charlie Collins, a Republican from Fayetteville, says Arkansas doesn't need a hate crime law. According to Collins, all convicted criminals should get the same sentence, regardless of who the victim is.
Purposeful, intentional, evil murder is evil murder, regardless of whether the victim is old, young, white, non-white, of one race or another race, one sexual orientation or another. And we need to prosecute violent crime aggressively for all victims, not just some victims.
During the same legislative session, Letting and Elliott's hate crime bill didn't make it out of committee. But the legislature did pass a bill that allows for enhanced penalties for crimes committed against law enforcement officers, a so-called Blue Lives Matter law. Collins says there's a difference between that law and a hate crime law.
We're not talking about the value of a particular sex, race, or age group. Because a person who is young or old in a police uniform, a person who is black or white in a police uniform, a person who is male or female in a police uniform, during the period of time that we're paying them to be a law enforcement officer and we are sending them into harm's way, it is something that to me is different because it doesn't value a particular type of person as a victim. It values a particular role, which is going to be more targeted.
Greg Letting, who plans to run for the state Senate District 4 seat next year, says he plans to introduce another hate crime bill during the 2019 legislative session if he's elected. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
So far, the Arkansas Times is the only media outlet in the natural state participating in ProPublica's Documenting Hate project. To find the form to submit information about a hate crime, you can go to documentinghate.com. We're also including a link to the form on our website at ozarksatlarge.com. You can find it by searching for this story.
You listen to NPR News on KUAF because you trust the journalism that brings you more than the headlines. One of the roles of a free press in a democracy is to fill in the half-truths and call out falsehoods. In times like these, this kind of reporting is essential, but it's also expensive. Your gift to KUAF helps pay for the news that's vital to all of us right now, and your support during the month of September helps us toward our fall fundraising goal of $150,000. Support KUAF and NPR News right now by making a gift at supportkuaf.com.
It is Monday, September 11th, 2017. This is Ozarks at Large. I have Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics on the phone with me. Happy Monday, Michael.
Yes, well, back at you.
I want to ask, let's update an interesting bit of news with this story that Talk Business has been following. And I think you've been following this since it was the City Wire. And it's about this burial mound.
Yep, we've been following since 2009. It's been an issue, really. Well before then, the archaeological, I think I've got the name right, Archaeological Conservancy bought it in 2006. But yes, it's a historic Native American mound, could be 1,000 years old. And it was originally, when it was originally built, it was about, to give people a sense of the size, 200 feet long at the base of each of the four sides and about 40 feet tall. But it's obviously, it's... the Caddo Indians didn't stick around to maintain it, so it's been in a state of disrepair now for several decades. The Conservancy bought it, and they've recently invested around $40,000 to restore one side of it. Was crumbling away. But the interesting thing is they knew that there was a family. It's the Stoppelman family, Heinrich and Katrina Stoppelman, who were immigrants. They came over on the boat and made their way somehow to Fort Smith, Arkansas, and somehow acquired property that had this mound on it. And their family, we don't yet know how many, but their family, at least Heinrich and Katrina, were buried on top of this mound. Well, the Conservancy tracked down a family member, a guy named Tim McDowell, who lives in Colorado. And well, actually Tim, it was kind of a mutual connection, but Tim learned about this. He was in Fort Smith a few years ago to restore a headstone on one of his great grandparents at Oak Cemetery in Fort Smith. While he was in town, he went to the genealogy department at the Fort Smith Public Library. Lo and behold, discovered he had family members buried on the mound, which still is interesting. When I was interviewing Tim, I said, you know, that's interesting. You know, how many, I don't know many families who just happen to have a family member buried on a, you know, a historic Indian mound. That's definitely unique. And he said that they've received a lot of questions about it. And interestingly enough, Tim said that he actually had some remorse about the fact that his family had used the mound that way. But he said, you know, those were different times. There was not the sensitivity about how you should or shouldn't use historic structures like that. So he did have a little bit of, and he wanted to let me know and the public know that, you know, yeah, they're proud of their family, but just kind of wish they hadn't buried themselves there.
This is a story for those of us who love history that just kind of keeps on giving, though.
Yes, and of course we're going to keep following it. And it, you know, the Conservancy doesn't yet know what they want to do with it when they finish. You know, their first goal is just to get it restored, get the trees and a lot of the vegetation off of it, get grass established, try to get it to looking to what they think those mounds look like. And then, you know, we'll see what we do with it. Hopefully, you know, maybe between the university, between the city and other groups, there could be some kind of small park, some small interpretive center, and it doesn't just kind of, you know,
languish.
Be forgotten again.
Yeah. All right, one last thing that I'm going to throw you a curveball. Did you last week have anyone call you up and wonder if Amazon was coming to Arkansas with their second headquarters?
No, I mean...
I got a few of those calls.
Well, then they obviously didn't read the story because Amazon made it clear where, you know, they want a metro area of at least 1 million people. I don't think there was one of those in Arkansas.
Not yet. In defense of the people who called up and were wondering, it was before the story actually broke.
Oh, all right.
So.
If they came to Arkansas, it would be a heck of a coup. Plus, Amazon is known for gigging at very high levels in terms of getting incentives, getting tax breaks, getting direct cash from cities and counties and states for their operations. I'm not sure Arkansas can afford to compete with some of the bigger states in terms of providing some of those incentives.
I'll put my money on Austin. How's that?
That's a good bet. That's one of the top bets.
All right. Well, we don't have Amazon second headquarters here, but Michael will be back with us on Friday. Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. You can read about The Mound and much more at talkbusiness.net. Michael, have a great week.
All right. You as well, Kyle. Thanks.
Since Hurricane Harvey, the National Flood Insurance Program has received more than 80,000 claims. Each claim needs an adjuster to inspect property. But the need to inspect quickly can bump up against inspecting accurately.
You want to make sure you see everything because I don't want to write something and then they have to come back with a supplement.
Plus, the impact of Hurricane Irma this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 3 to 6 on 91.3.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. The Alma Performing Arts Center presents recording artist Exile in concert Thursday, September 21st at 7:30 p.m. This classic rock country crossover band produced such hits as Kiss You All Over, Woke Up in Love, She's a Miracle, and more. Tickets and information at almapac.org or 632-2129. KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2017 Hillbury Music Festival, October 12th through the 15th, on the farm in Eureka Springs. This four-day camping, bluegrass music festival welcomes Yonder Mountain String Band, Old Salt Union, the Squashers, and more. Winners will be announced Friday, September 29th, during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. Register and find information at our website, KUAF.com.
Still to come on today's show, the House of Songs began in Austin. Now it has a new second permanent home in Bentonville. House of Songs, Northwest Arkansas style, still ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, September 11th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. Many flags are flying at half-mast today in recognition of the 16th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in New York, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Nearly 3,000 people died as a result of those attacks. Bentonville-based Walmart is launching a second hurricane relief effort. The retailer announced yesterday it would have another two-for-one match for relief efforts geared toward the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. This after a previous campaign for Hurricane Harvey. In a Sunday blog post, Walmart outlined the details of the second fundraising event lasting through the week. The retailer will match customer donations 2-to-1 in cash and products up to $10 million. Enrollment at the University of Arkansas this fall is another all-time record, more than 27,500 students. But the rate of growth is slowing. The new number represents a 1.3% growth rate, much lower than the better than 12% growth rate experienced the past 5 years. It is the 19th consecutive year enrollment has grown. The fall 2017 class is made up of 55% Arkansans, non-residents making up nearly 40% of the class, and international students just over 5%. And the University of Arkansas Fort Smith reporting an increase of students as well. UAFS has just over 6,600 students, an increase of about 50 students compared to last year. More than 1,100 of those enrolled at UAFS are first-time students. That's a 3% growth in that demographic compared to last autumn. The school also reports a 12% increase in continuing freshmen. And the Northwest Arkansas Naturals baseball season is over. Last night, the Nats lost the fifth and deciding game of the Texas League North Championship Series in Tulsa. Perhaps no other recreational or entertainment experience is more globally shared than soccer, or as it's known around the world, football. The World Cup competitions begin with qualifying rounds involving nearly every country in the world. By the time the World Cup will end in 2018, an estimated 3 billion people will have watched part of the tournament. Beyond international play are thousands of leagues of clubs, professional and otherwise, attracting passion and attention on six continents. The impact the sport has on the planet, and vice versa, will be the subject of an honor symposium on the University of Arkansas campus next spring. Todd Cleveland, an assistant professor of history at the University of Arkansas, will lead the seminar. And Wednesday this week, he'll deliver a preview lecture open to the public. It will take place in Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. Recently, Todd talked with us about the lecture, the seminar, and his own devotion to the global game.
Every Saturday morning, I'm sitting there watching Arsenal, texting friends all over the world about, you know, the developments during the game. So it has a very strong sort of unifying factor in that sense. Of course, you have these interesting situations where former colonial powers play their former colonies in when they're engaged in national squad matches. And so you have all these really sort of interesting networks and connections that transcend borders, continental borders, national borders, et cetera, that sort of bring folks together in a way that that's very unique. Even though I think there are roughly 1 billion more soccer fans than there are cricket fans, but I still don't think cricket has that sort of unifying dimension to it the way that soccer does.
Why has it excelled where other games have not?
Sure, that's a really good question. And to answer that, you have to go back to the sort of dissemination of the game, which happened largely at the end of the 19th century and into the early 20th century. It was a working class game, so it wasn't a game played by elites. So in that sense, it resonated with even colonized subjects in different communities, different areas around the world were more receptive to soccer vis-a-vis cricket or rugby for that matter, or any sort of other sport that was played by only a handful of people who had learned the sport going through, or as they transitioned through elite institutions in various European stops. So it had that sort of appeal. It was played by sailors, by soldiers, folks who actually interacted with the sort of different populations, different colonized populations for that matter, around the world. And so it was much more quickly adopted, reasonably quickly adapted or appropriated and changed in many ways that generated some sort of discontent among the Europeans who had introduced the game in a sort of, in a fashion they thought would be sort of slavishly imitated. But of course, there were certain local cultural factors proclivities that led to the game sort of taking on its own shape and its own form with various strategies that, yes, it all looked like soccer if you looked at it from 10,000 feet, but it had very sort of different characteristics. And so there was a way that local communities could adapt the game to their sort of athletic traditions and athletic priorities in a way that was, I would say, unanticipated and perhaps unique among different sports.
If colonization helped spread the game, has the game influenced the world the other way around in any way?
That's a very good question. I would say it has the ability to unite, but also to disunite. Sometimes existing fault lines within communities will really come into sharp contrast as a result of sporting rivalries. I mean, we see that in the United States to a certain extent. A Red Sox fan can hate a Yankees fan, that type of thing. It doesn't necessarily or really ever anymore boil over into something more. But those rivalries can be more hostile, more deeply entrenched in other environments. And so unfortunately, too, if you look back at the origins of some of these clubs, they're associated with, say, perhaps a certain profession. And so if you go far enough back, you can see that a certain club, or a particular club, may have a certain identity. And that identity, though, has largely been overwhelmed by, let's say, if it's an English club or something like that, all the money and everything else. There are certain roots that some of these clubs have that some of the fans sort of hang on to with a sort of very keen sense of tradition that will perpetuate some of those rivalries. So I think that, in that sense, it does have the ability to shape societies, although I wouldn't want to overstate that necessarily.
Sure. For many fans, because soccer is not as wildly popular in the United States as it is in many other. I mean, there was the old joke, soccer is the sport of the United States future and it always will be. I think it does have a foothold.
Sure.
But for many fans here, it's international soccer they think of, World Cup, as opposed to Arsenal or the Premiership.
Sure.
What's the difference in perspective there?
Yeah, there's so many folks who are, friends of mine who are uninterested, in the sort of the weekly grind. Arsenal's playing Stoke this weekend or whatever. I'm never going to watch that. Mm-hmm. But if the United States has a match, even if it's a friendly against Trinidad and Tobago or something like that, that suddenly becomes worth watching. And in a way, I'm unique or I'm different than that sort of soccer fan in the sense that I don't follow the U.S. national team because I think I have much more of an appreciation for the rich history of club soccer, which predates national team soccer. And so these clubs have existed since the late 1800s, where a lot of national teams were formed later, subsequently, for different reasons. And so I appreciate the sense of history and tradition that some of these clubs have and some of the leagues have. And I think that that's lost on the sort of casual soccer fan who for all sorts of wonderful reasons, wants to watch only when their country participates. There's a, you know, it generates some sense of nationalism, no matter how insignificant, where we all gather in a bar to watch the United States play, in a way that those same fans don't necessarily have an appreciation of the game, because they're not going to stick around for the ensuing game, which is Belgium against Cameroon in a friendly. So that it's not that they're engaged with soccer necessarily as a sport because they absolutely love it. It's a way to express their patriotism, no matter how insignificant, by watching the United States.
It's interesting because United States athletic is almost always a favorite. Track and field, basketball, almost always. Not so much hockey, but still one of the players.
Sure.
When it comes to soccer, it's one of the places where the United States can still be a legit serious underdog.
Yeah, we're regularly humbled. Which is, yeah, it's interesting. We so there's been this debate ever since the MLS was organized that the players, our best players, should stay home and cultivate the league, help the league to grow in popularity, or whether they should go to Europe and play with essentially the best players in the world. I've always been in sort of the latter camp, and you know, we're on, it's very hypocritical because, of course, for, if you follow the NBA or baseball for that matter, I mean, what's happening in the United States, they're drawing the best athletes from around the world, and we're accustomed to that. But God forbid one or two American players should go abroad to try to improve their skills, and therefore the prospects of the United States national team. So that's been an interesting sort of debate and phenomenon. And Klinsmann, the most recent U.S. national team's national team coach, was encouraging American players to go abroad, unlike some of his predecessors, but with mixed results. I mean, it's not that formulaic that if you send your best players to Europe, you are therefore going to win the World Cup or come even close, for that matter. We simply at this point don't have our best athletes playing soccer. And that may change as you see more families encourage their kids to gravitate away from American football towards soccer. You may well start seeing some of the better athletes engage in soccer, and that will increase our chances for, you know, to go further in these tournaments. It's still going to take a long, long time.
When you have the address on Wednesday night, when you're talking about the seminar that will be in the spring, what are you going to, because that's open to the public, what will you talk about?
Sure. Really just want to talk, I mean, sort of the, some of the questions that you led with, like, why? Why is soccer so huge? Why is soccer so dominant on the global sporting landscape? And how did it get to be that way? And I mean, I'm sort of well-positioned to answer some of those questions as a historian, because you really, really do have to go back into a period in which Europe dominated the world, or the world in many respects, and had colonies far-flung, scattered colonies all over the world, and they were actively introducing soccer, not always for well-intentioned purposes, because it was a way that they thought that they could inculcate, that they could reinforce a sense of respect for authority, which in this case was a European referee, and also combat in a way the notion that these tropical communities were inherently lazy, that this was something else to sort of motivate them, to get them from lying around. This was all part of the sort of bigger Protestant work ethic conversation. But I think it's very interesting to me to kind of trace these processes back through history to understand, you know, how we got to this point where the world's crazy about soccer.
Todd Cleveland is an assistant professor of history at the University of Arkansas, and next spring he'll lead an Honors College signature seminar about soccer. It'll be open to students in the Honors College at the U of A. Wednesday, he'll present a preview of that seminar in a talk open to the public. That presentation will begin at 5:15 Wednesday evening in Gerhard Hall Auditorium, and it is free. Next week, we'll preview another signature seminar series when we have a conversation with Stephanie Schulte, an associate professor of communication at the U of A, and we'll talk about her seminar about the internet. That's next week on Ozarks at Large.
The 16th annual Brits in the Ozarks All British Car and Cycle Show, benefiting the ALS Association of Northwest Arkansas, is set for September 14th through the 16th at the Pauline Whitaker Equine Pavilion in Fayetteville.
as well as other locations throughout Northwest Arkansas. Guest speaker is writer, collector, and consultant Andy Reed. BritishIronNWA.org to register or for information. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. Dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
About a year ago, we brought you a story about a temporary visit of the Austin, Texas-based House of Songs project to Northwest Arkansas. House of Songs is a literal house in Austin, where founder Troy Campbell brings together songwriters from that city and elsewhere to write new music. Last year, he helped coordinate with the I'll Fly Away Foundation from Here, a project connecting Australians and Arkansans, to complete some unfinished songs by Albert Brumley, the man who wrote I'll Fly Away and thousands of other songs. At that time, Campbell and I'll Fly Away Foundation board members Betsy Brumley and Kevin Bernier told me that someday, maybe there could be a permanent House of Songs project in Northwest Arkansas. And Friday afternoon, more than a half dozen people creating front porch music at the corner of 6th and C Streets near downtown Bentonville. This is the House of Songs, Northwest Arkansas. For this House of Songs, project founder Troy Campbell settled on a turn-of-the-century Victorian home with three floors. He's created a space where he wants songwriters to feel comfortable while acknowledging the home's history. When people enter the house, there is a piano to the left in almost the exact spot where a piano rested in the original music room a century ago.
And when you walk into the house, you'll see photos to the right, and those are the actual original owner's daughters. So each corner of Campbell's Corner here at 6th and C was done by the same builder, and he built a house for each of his daughters.
Troy Campbell leads a quick tour for visitors and points out eventually every room in this house will carry a name shared with a different Arkansas musical figure.
This is the Johnny Cash room. This is one of the biggest rooms. And so we have his image always watching us. And we use this for concerts. So this room, we just recently did a soft opening during Fayetteville Roots. So we had a wonderful concert here, an open house. So we wanted all the neighbors to come over. So all the neighborhood came over, and they told us the history of the house, which was wonderful.
Other rooms bear names like Sister Rosetta Tharp, Lucinda Williams, and Al Bell, one-time president of both Stax and Motown Records. That's the part that's inspirational. There's also the practical, a redone kitchen and new appliances.
And so part of the House of Songs is to always have a nice washer and dryer, because we know artists, that's the one thing that's always missing in your touring life.
Friday afternoon, none of the songwriters were tending to laundry. They were outside, sitting on the porch, shoes kicked off, guitars in hand, and notebooks spread out all around. A major part of the House of Songs framework is designed around pairing songwriters who've never met into duos and then letting the newly formed teams create. In the first 24 hours of this incarnation, that's happened. But so has this multi-songwriting effort. On the porch are songwriters from Austin, Graham Wilkinson, Miranda Dawn, and Chris Hawks, and songwriters from the Ozarks, Isaac Duncan, Jeff Kearney, Meredith Kimbrough, and Eric Whithands. The songwriters have, at this point, been together about a day, and each decided to take a verse in a song that, despite being about 12 hours old and not quite finished, has a timeless sing-along feel.
This song in particular has been incubating. We started it yesterday with a smaller group, and so I guess with everybody here right now, we've spent about
25
minutes.
Yeah. An hour?
Only
about 25 minutes for me,
yeah. Yeah. It all started with a melody and a chorus, and then we all just kind of... everyone
took a verse.
Yeah, we're kind of trying that out. I think it's working out. It's definitely a sing-along tune, so it kind of lends itself to having a group do it.
Don't bump my shoulder. Pick up. Pick up.
Pick up.
The first songwriters at this House of Songs say collaborating like this can be like having somebody offer that one needed clue for a crossword puzzle. Miranda Dawn, sitting cross-legged with her back resting on the porch's railing, says it can be just like having a conversation.
You're learning about everyone's history and stories and heartbreaks or things that they celebrate, and little pieces of it just get put in the story and of the song, you know, and that comes across in everyone's guitar playing or instrument playing from their voice and intonation or from the words they pick. And so I like collaborations. I think they can be really beautiful.
By Friday afternoon, one of the collaborating duos had already finished a song. Others were working. What happens to the music after a House of Songs is done is wide open. Past sessions have led to music performed live and recorded for artists on albums. Graham Wilkinson, originally from Arkansas but now living in and performing out of Austin, says the experience of past House of Song efforts proves that the experiences can have lasting effects.
It's comforting to be around people who are as crazy and neurotic as me. It's like, I don't know if that's the right word, but...
Makes me feel like I'm not so alone.
Yeah, it's like it's going over and over again about a line, and then when one person in the group says a line and everybody immediately agrees, that is what we were all looking for, and I think all of us definitely spend time all by ourselves trying to write, you know?
It's all about that moment where it clicks, right? And, yeah. and you feel that energy there. And you can do that by yourself, but yeah, what you said, when you have seven minds working on it, it kind of throws gas on the fire.
And there's somebody to high-five afterward. Yeah.
This House of Songs may have been an incomplete dream just a year ago, but its reality doesn't completely surprise Troy Campbell. He says there is a certain level of serendipity attached to this entire project. He says the work with Betsy and Kevin from the All Fly Away Foundation that led to what's happening this week first began with what Troy calls an interesting and auspicious first meeting with Betsy Brumley at the Folk Alliance, an annual gathering of singers and songwriters.
I was laying on a floor in the lobby hiding from the musicians I was currently working with so I could play guitar and hear my own thoughts, because I had 15 artists from around the world and we were working on this fabulous film project. And then I was hiding and Betsy comes up and decides to start talking to me. I'm laying on my back with my eyes closed thinking, well, this is a pretty good sign. Don't bother me. And she just goes, hello.
I just sat down beside him and just said,
goes, you seem you really interesting. Yeah, you seem interesting. I'm going to sit with you. And I was like, okay.
Not much long after that, Betsy and Troy sit in the music room of the just inaugurated new House of Songs discussing how much they want the spirit of creativity to thrive here. And just a few feet away on the front porch, Graham Wilkinson, guitar cradled in his hands, says the opportunity to spend time with fellow songwriters with the goal of just writing is a godsend, but it's still work.
The intentionality behind it is still there. It's just I think we're fortunate enough to be in this kind of environment because, you know, we had a schedule. We had to wake up this morning, and it was time to do this. And everybody here has been, you know, super pro and intentional.
There is an element of the House of Songs concept that isn't unfamiliar in 2017. Surfing across cable television will reveal dozens of shows about bringing strangers together to cook, design, sing, or somehow create a house, only to be judged and, one by one, eliminated from that house. Troy Campbell says competition is not part of this house, however.
Yeah, we don't have contestants. We have human beings. You know, contestants are great, but to have chemistry here and have people working together, that's what mankind's about. That's what people are supposed to do. That's how we become greater.
The singers involved with the House of Songs were at a welcoming party yesterday at Preacher's Son in downtown Bentonville and will be at Heartbreak House on Block Avenue in downtown Fayetteville tonight, beginning at 6. The documentary about the House of Songs project involving Australian singers coming to Northwest Arkansas to finish the songs of Albert Brumley will also be shown there. Troy Campbell says future House of Songs sessions in Bentonville will include songwriters from Greenland, Pakistan, and Cuba. We'll keep you up to date. This is Ozarks at Large.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Stay with us for the latest on Hurricane Irma.
NPR reporters will be across Florida hearing from first responders and those affected by the storm.
Floridians are strong. We're resilient. In times like this, we band together and help each other.
Next time, here and now.
Coming up from 1 to 3 this afternoon on 91.3. It is Monday. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Welcome back.
This is part two.
Part two of yesterday morning, we started talking about the Fayetteville Film Festival.
Correct. And this is part two. Here's a theory for filmmaking now.
Mm-hmm.
Comes from a gentleman named Russell Sherman, who teaches film in the Department of Communication at the university.
All right.
Don't wait around for permission.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid to make your own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And don't wait for somebody to tell you you're good enough. Basically, he says everybody can make a film.
Well, you can probably, well, I don't think probably, if you know how, you can make one with your iPhone.
Oh, yeah, that the technology exists. And he says, okay, so the first one may be terrible. And it's going to look a lot better if you have a real camera, not the camera on your iPhone.
Sure.
But he's going to be talking to student filmmakers at Fayetteville High School Tuesday as part of the Fayetteville Film Festival and encouraging them to go out and make their own stuff. Because here's what happens. You make your own stuff, it gets seen. If you want to work in film, that's how you get in.
It's a visual resume.
Exactly. And so if you want to see what the Fayetteville High School kids and high school kids from other places have been making, at 4:30 tomorrow, they will be screening those at the Fayetteville High School Performing Arts Center.
Oh, fun.
And then also, Thursday night is the opening red carpet shindig for the film festival. Here's the cool part. Another person I didn't know existed. Very excited. His name's Ryan Cockerham, and he teaches at Northwest Arkansas Community College. He teaches music theory. Well, he got this bee in his bonnet that he wanted to play music for silent films.
Okay. Oh, sure.
Yeah. Right. Like the old days when there was an organist who played.
And often music was written specifically for a film, or if not, you had these parts like Car Chase,
right.
Avalanche. Right.
Right. Oddly enough, Grandma played at the cinema in Pettigrew.
His grandmother.
My grandmother.
Your grandmother
Dan's
played.
Dan's grandmother
okay.
played at the cinema in Pettigrew.
Wow.
So, anyway, that has nothing to do with anything. He decided that he was going to bring these musicians together, and he was going to score silent films.
Mm-hmm.
They don't write anything down. They pick a film. They watch it several times. They play it. So every time they play it, it's different. And this has gone from him doing this in his classroom at NWAC to doing it all over the country. He's got gigs like in, let's see, San Antonio, Houston, Little Rock, and Tulsa this fall, plus the opening gig for the film festival. And they'll be doing little pieces of film, like a little piece of Nosferatu.
Ah, The vampire movie, which is fantastic.
Or a little piece of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Which
or
is Metropolis,
which he really likes.
And these are all fantastic movies.
He said the great part about them being live is they played the score to Metropolis this summer when a storm was rushing in on the Hot Springs Art in the Park Festival, and it was gloomy, and it was scary, and it really changed how the film affected the music, affected the musicians who affected the film.
It's a live experience.
It's a live experience. This happens at 7 o'clock Thursday at the UARC Bowl.
Right, right. That's on Dixon Street.
And it's free.
And so
you can just go there.
And you say this is not a single film. He's going to do snippets.
Snippets of several things. And for $12, you can get an armband. It's free to get in.
Mm-hmm.
$12, you get an armband and you get craft beer from Fossil Cove and Apple Blossom and Core and Lost 40. Well, it's the bargain of the week.
Yeah, it is.
And let's see. Also this week, on Tuesday night, the preview of the Vietnam War, which is a new AETN thing. Mm-hmm. that happens at 6 o'clock at the Fort Smith Public Library, and then it premieres on AETN on the 17th.
And on Saturday afternoon, I'll be at the Fayetteville Public Library with a panel discussion, a screening there, and then afterwards, folks like Roy Reed and a representative from the Library of Congress and Randall Woods, and we'll talk about it.
Cool.
That's Saturday at the library, Fayetteville Library.
And then Village on the Creeks Writers and Poets has moved to Tuesday night. That happens at 6 o'clock at the Artist Retreat Center in Bella Vista, and their guest this week is J.C. Crumpton. Mm-hmm. Second Tuesday Night Salon, another author, Lana Givens, who is the author of Peculiar Texas, not to be confused with Midnight Texas. She'll be at the Gathering in Rogers, hosted by Trolley Line Books.
And that's Tuesday night.
And that's Tuesday night. Tuesday night's also the Faculty Music Showcase at UAFS at 7:30 at the Blue Lion. And then on Thursday, there's an author talk with Romilyn Tillman, author of To the Stars Through Difficulties. Uh-huh. At the Fayetteville Public Library at 6 o'clock, and a classical outreach concert on Friday with Irish pianist Michael McHale playing at Covenant Church in Fayetteville at 7 o'clock.
Well, don't tell me you got nothing to do.
Tell me how to do it all.
Yeah, there you go.
My vitamins are not working that well.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
I was born in the wagon of a traveling show. My mama had to dance for the money they'd throw. Papa would do whatever he could. Preach a little gospel. Sell a couple bottles of Dr. Good.
After years of researching Arkansas music and musicians, Arkansas is confident in the state's outsized role in the American musical vernacular. It's also why we're secure enough to present a few of a surprising number of musical legends who are almost Arkansasers themselves. Many take Grammy, Emmy, and Academy Award-winning performer Cher's 1973 number one song, Half-Breed, literally, that she is of Native American ancestry. In fact, her father was Armenian-American, and her actress-model mother, Jackie Jean Crouch, was born in 1927 in Kinsett in White County. Crouch, also known as Georgia Holt, was taught to play guitar by her father. She sang with Bob Wills and appeared on I Love Lucy. Friendly with Ahmet Erdogan, the head of Atlantic Records, she told him about Cher, but he wasn't interested. Ironically, Sonny and Cher did sign to Atlantic, and after I Got You, Babe became an international smash, she got to tell Erdogan, I told you so. In 2013, the Arkansaser and her daughter appeared in the documentary Dear Mom, Love Cher.
Grandma's maiden name was on the lines, and there's 90 years to tell about in a few short lines. Born in Newton County, down in Arkansas.
Country music legend Merle Haggard's grandfather, John Bohannon Harp, was born in Harrison, and his grandmother, Martha Frances Arizona Belle Valines Harp, was from Beechwood in Newton County. Their daughter, Merle's mother, was also born in Harrison. Merle recorded Grandma Harp in 1972 about his Arkansas roots. Multiple Grammy winner Robert McFerrin Jr. is better known as Bobby McFerrin. He's also known for his polyphonic vocal stylings and scat singing in the jazz, classical, and pop worlds, culminating in the 1988 worldwide smash Don't Worry, Be Happy, the first ever a cappella number one hit in the United States. His dad, Robert Keith McFerrin Sr., was born 1921 in Marianna in Lee County and has his own strong musical legacy as a gospel vocalist, as an operatic baritone, and a vocal teacher. He died in 2006. Miles Davis Sr. and Miles Davis Jr. were both born and lived in Jefferson County, Arkansas, while Miles Davis III, the jazz trumpeter of renown, was born in Alton, Illinois, and grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois. But the Davis family continued to own its large farm near Pine Bluff for decades, and young Miles III frequently returned to the Davis homestead in Arkansas. Born in 1898, Miles' dad was a dentist who attended what is now the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, as well as Arkansas Baptist College in Little Rock. Miles Davis Jr. also was a champion hog breeder and ran for a seat in the Illinois legislature. Indiana-born Michael Jackson, who died in 2009, called himself the King of Pop. And that may have been true. His album Thriller is the best-selling album of all time, and he remains a global icon. His father, Joseph Walter Jackson, was born in 1928 in Fountain Hill in Ashley County in South Arkansas and was himself a guitarist. But Joe Jackson's true legacy is in siring and managing the incredibly talented and successful Jackson family. He was not only Michael's father and manager, but also of the brother group that preceded Michael, the Jackson Five, and the solo careers of Jackie, Tito, Jermaine, Marlon, and Randy, and daughters Rebby, Latoya, and Janet. Each in this diverse collection of artists altered the American musical landscape, and each has their own Arkansas connection. Here in its entirety is Merle Haggard's 1972 number one single about his Arkansas family connections, Grandma Harp.
Grandma's maiden name was on the lines. There's 90 years to tell about in a few short lines. Born in Newton County, down in Arkansas. Then in 1901, she married Grandpa. We laid her soul to rest on Sunday morning. And everybody knew she'd done her part. Don't get set to hear no hidden family legend. Just a song about the life of Grandma Harp.
Just think about the times that she lived through. And think about the changing world she saw. Now somehow she reared a decent family out of poverty. And for 70 years she loved the same old Grandpa. To me, her passing brought a closing chapter to a way of life that I loved within my heart. I just mean to say I think we owe her something special. If just a song about the life of Grandma Harp.
Grandma's maiden name was on the lines. And there's 90 years to tell about in a few short lines. Born in Newton County, down in Arkansas. Then in 1901, she married Grandpa. We laid her soul to rest one Sunday morning. And everybody knew she'd done her part. Don't get set to hear no hidden family legend. Just a song about the life of Grandma Harp.
Grandma Harp, Merle Haggard's number one single about his Arkansas family connections from 1972. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support provided by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Mount Kessler. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums, another brand new edition of our daily program tomorrow at noon and 7 on KUAF. As always, you can find individual stories and past full editions of our program online at OzarksAtLarge.com and at KUAF.com. Thanks so much for spending some of your day with us. Have a great rest of your Monday.